That was well timed, wasn't it? We're talking about Infantino in Washington last week not meeting Biden. Then who does he meet at the Formula One?
Lewis Hamilton.
A Kardashian.
Well, he didn't post pictures on his Instagram, but someone snapped him at a distance. Donald Trump.
Ah.
Well, it's clear, isn't it, that of the two, former President Trump and Biden, Infantino clearly has warmer relationships with Trump. Election year. I wonder who Infantino will be hoping for.
I wonder who so much was going on at that Miami Grand Prix. Much to get into on this episode. Hello, welcome again to Sports Unlocked. Joining me, Rob Harris from Sky News as ever, Martin Ziegler from The Times, and Tariq Panja from The New York Times. And hard not to start on FIFA when apparently there's a comedy about to be produced about them. I mean, there's never much to laugh about around FIFA.
No, this is apparently the sitcom W1A, which was about previously set about the within the BBC. That was a follow-up itself from a comedy around the London 2012 Olympics. Now it looks like this is around about FIFA, with a sort of bumbling British executive played by Hugh Bonneville of Downton Abbey fame. I'm not quite sure what he's going to be doing, what role he's going to be playing, but I can't wait. And especially I can't wait to see who's going to be playing you, Tariq.
Yeah. Well, come on. We can go to our email to get in touch.
Give us sportunlockpod@gmail.com. Message us. Sportunlocked on X, Facebook and Instagram. But for those less familiar, it was a BBC One sort of parody of behind the scenes at organisation, some of the auditors of the Olympics to start with in 2012. Most memorable because it featured something, if I remember, about a countdown clock not working, and that happened in real life within days.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it, they were ahead of their time. With FIFA, guys, shortage of material? Is there enough weirdness over the years at FIFA?
Well, we're wondering who's writing this, because few of us who might know some of the insider stuff, even we don't mention on here. Although, even if you just listen to this pod over the last 150 episodes, it'd be quite a lot of material.
I'm sure there's going to be loads of things to write about, aren't there? You know, when you can, new competitions, you know, rows over the World Cup, you know, it's going to be, I think you can make it really funny, actually. Funnier than real life.
Yeah, well, one of the key characters in the BBC version as well is Siobhan, PR person, so yeah. Surely it will feature the comms department. You've got to imagine about how they, you know, struggle through instances.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen some calamitous public relations issues over the years, guys. Look, who would, while we're thinking about this, you know, when you think about FIFA stories, do you have any of your own that you were there and you think, God, that was weird? I mean, I can think of a few myself. Martin, anything like you think, oh my God, that this would make a great kind of moment for a sitcom?
Well, I mean, obviously there was the Sepp Blatter being showered with dollar bills. Which was a fairly remarkable moment. The struggle is going to be people think that's too outrageous. It's probably not as outrageous as real life.
Yeah, my personal one, if you're thinking about it, during that famous bidding contest, just towards the end of the 2018 bidding competition, we're trying to ask the late Julio Grondona, the vice president of FIFA at the time, Argentine FA president, if he would vote for England, knowing you're going to get a response. And we ended up, he was trying to get away, but we got trapped in a revolving door at the FIFA entrance. And he turned to me and he said, "If England give us back the Falklands, of course I'll vote for them." And then the door swung away. Right, okay. Cards on the table.
One of them, from what I understand, one of the more far-fetched storylines is that the FIFA president in the programme is going to do a press conference.
It'll be completely outlandish, though, Martin, if there's a press conference, because that just doesn't happen, does it?
Well, I can imagine there'll be stuff around about, you know, FIFA's having sort of relationships with, you know, very rich Gulf states with questionable human rights record, and people running around the PR department trying to justify various things. I mean, I think there's plenty of scope for material there.
Yeah, EasyJet, a private jet as well, that journey.
They will do a rebrand one. Do they change the name of FIFA?
Oh, yeah. That's a good one. because it's been so tarnished. What are they going to call it?
So they'll come up with all ridiculous sorts of names. Ball or something.
Ball. World football.
Yeah, they'll have all the branding options.
Yeah, football, soccer. World soccer.
Yeah. 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 And maybe it'll then just be F or S. You know, I can imagine the wall of all the different brands and logos they're trying to get the FIFA president to sign up to.
Truly global.
They won't be able to have world soccer, are they? Because there's World Soccer Magazine.
Good point, yeah.
Maybe they can call it FC, or is that already gone?
Well, it's the name of the rival game, FIFA game. That's after FIFA split with EA Sports.
Oh, dear. So they've lost
EA FC, so yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of fodder, though, isn't it? It's in a bigger sense. It's the world soup. All of those countries bashed in together, 211. All the various characters and situations that arise as a result of the fact all these people have come together that with their own often very narrow interests. Sometimes what's good for the individual himself or herself, rather than anything broader than that. And then the compromises people have made. And I think being in those rooms and sort of sending some of that up could be good TV.
Yeah, I did say to someone at FIFA, you know, good to be talked about. Don't they be creating one of these comedies about world taekwondo or even rugby necessarily. People can relate to FIFA, the individuals, the characters, or a perception of what they should be or what they think they actually are.
Especially since World Taekwondo changed their name, because when they were the World Taekwondo Federation, that was like obviously my favourite acronym, but they got fed up with people taking the mic, and so they changed it.
WTF, and maybe that can apply to the Miami Grand Prix, where who stepped into all the mix? Donald Trump went around McLaren, letting McLaren have to sort of scramble out a statement defending why they had the former president and all sorts of legal issues in the paddock before the race. And then of all things, their driver Lando Norris wins his first ever F1 Grand Prix, allowing Trump to claim the credit.
The Trump effect in full effect there for Lando Norris. So you're saying that these Grand Prix, these teams would need a kind of blessing from Donald Trump, and that gives them an extra oomph?
You know, it was something that his PR person was posting a lot of videos. There was no obvious clips of booing from around the race, which is surprising, because normally any politician goes to an event, certainly you'd imagine in the UK, there'd be, you know, quite a few boos.
I suppose where it is and perhaps the audience as well for Formula One. But yeah, like you say, it was noticed.
And perhaps he took some of the limelight away from Gianni Infantino, who was wandering on the grid as well. And interestingly, his Instagram features so many pictures of people that he meets. You'd think a former US president, someone of such high ranking, he'd want to post a picture of. But the only image we saw was someone taking it from a distance to a fence that posted on social media.
He may not have had his photographer with him at the time. That's possible.
There is tension between the Biden administration, and there has been, and FIFA and Infantino. We saw that in Qatar. In 2022, Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, he went to the World Cup and didn't meet with Gianni Infantino, watched the US and came home. Biden himself and Infantino, if they have met, it hasn't been a White House meeting, unlike those meetings with Trump that we've mentioned. So maybe the optics of that right now might be something that perhaps FIFA and Infantino were careful about.
But then he went from Miami to the West Coast to the Milken Institute conference, where he did have an encounter with one of Trump's former cabinet secretaries.
Is this Steven Mnuchin, Rob?
That is the person, yeah.
Mnuchin's interesting as well, because he's set up a fund with Jared Kushner, another person Donald Trump probably familiar with, his son-in-law. And the biggest investors in that fund, guys, Saudi Arabia. So another group that's not far from Gianni's heart, perhaps.
The Milken Institute themselves? Who's behind that?
Michael Milken, junk bond king, also convicted felon. He was convicted of securities fraud in the 90s, and pardoned by Donald Trump. So it all goes round and round. But this Milken Institute conference is a big deal in the US, whether the people we're talking about are there or not, huge deal for financiers. It just made me think how some people are able to be rehabilitated and others not. These people swarm over to Michael Milken's conference despite this you know, the crimes he had committed and pled guilty to in the past. And others aren't afforded that chance to return so kind of triumphantly and so publicly as Michael Milken has.
And the Institute's Instagram account, sitting on my feed, promoted tweets kept on appearing, I don't follow them, of Gianni on stage. It was him sort of joking and walking around, this is a football, this is a soccer ball.
So this is a soccer ball, right? Soccer ball. We are speaking about that. We call it football. We spoke already about that. So I put it here with you. So it's even branded with the, you see?
Yeah, it's perfect.
With the conference of today. It's fantastic. So we all know what we are speaking about, in case somebody had some doubts, because there are also a lot of not only social but economic questions around soccer.
Going for that sort of shtick about, is it football, is it soccer?
I feel he does that quite a lot, that shtick. I wonder when it will get tired. Rob, what, it seemed he had some words to say as well. He was interviewed, and I think he pretty much has said stuff he'd said in the past about his views of where US club soccer is. What did he say exactly?
Yeah, he was telling MLS clubs to sign some of the better players to strengthen the league, which maybe that's part of making football truly global, as he said. Maybe it would be sort of taking talent from other parts of the world into the US. Does that make football global doing so? Does it take away some of the power from Europe, even from the Middle East and Saudi Arabia, by helping to beef up another league? Or, yeah, is it a brain drain, a talent drain from other parts of the world?
Yeah, I feel he has a point, though. He's been saying it for about 8 years. And you're right. He's actually saying, you guys are the biggest economy in the world. You always want to be number one at everything. You've got all of these rich people in your country. A lot of them own your football teams. Can you put your hands in your pockets like you do for other things and become a major player in club soccer? And about brain drains and players from other countries, how do we think the Premier League is made up? Where do you think these players are coming from? A lot of them aren't English. His point is, if you want to be watching the best football, you kind of have to invest in it. And he's been saying that. And as far as he's concerned, that hasn't happened. It's interesting how that's received over there.
Yeah, well, we'll see if the game's growth is helped, not just by the 2026 World Cup when it's in the US, Canada, Mexico, but the Club World Cup in the US in 2025. We're, what, 13 months away from this big launch of the new expanded competition, up from 7 teams as it is now annually to 32 teams every 4 years. But is the planning so simple? FIFA pushing ahead? No rights deal in place yet? And now we've got the players through the World Union FIFPro and the World Leagues Association protesting with a letter that's been sent to FIFA ahead of the Congress and Council next week in Bangkok, demanding, effectively, it isn't held at all next year. They're calling for review, but they're, what I believe they mean is, there's no space for it in the calendar. It shouldn't be next year.
Yeah, it was a very hard-hitting letter, really. Not basically saying the sort of the scale of the demands on football is abusive, that it's FIFA's looking after its own commercial interests, damaging the commercial viability of the leagues, putting too much pressure on players, significant risk of injury. And actually says that if they don't reschedule the Club World Cup next year and drop the Continental Cup, which is going to be the sort of revamped old Club World Cup, then they will look at their options, including legal action, which they've already taken legal advice on. So it does seem like they're sort of throwing down the gauntlet.
Yeah, I thought the most interesting thing here, look at it in the context, and you have to look at what's happened in the last year. The European Court of Justice ruling in the Super League case, it basically warned UEFA and, you know, by extent FIFA, that you have to be careful that you're not acting as monopolies, affecting other people's businesses to suit yourself. We had a case last week about the transfer system with Lassana Diarra, again, with a European court ruling that appeared to favour the party that isn't FIFA, the player and other football players. And the thing in this letter, Martin, the thing that I found most interesting was it was a direct kind of assertion of this, like right in the middle of this letter, on the top of the second page, it says sports governing bodies such as FIFA must adhere to transparent, objective, non-discriminatory and proportionate safeguards given their inherent conflict of interest in acting both as regulators and competition organisers. Now, if you were want to be a bit geeky and geek out, look at the ECJ ruling in the Super League case, and you will see words like transparent, objective, non-discriminatory in that ruling. So if this goes to court, which I don't think it will, because things usually get so, if it does get tested in court, it's a good chance FIFA could lose here.
And what's it ultimately about, though? Is it about money? So we saw that the European Club Association were completely against this Club World Cup in 2019 when it was being advanced. Of course, that was an ECA led by Andrea Agnelli, no longer in place. They were, you know, UEFA also, you know, refusing to allow European teams, I think, to take part, if I remember rightly. Let's flip to the present. And the ECA are part of the commercial partnership with FIFA selling the rights to the Club World Cups. They've got a financial interest in it. And we've got 12 European teams that are going to be part of it. So the question is that what the unions and the leagues are looking for, to join this commercial entity to gain more financially themselves?
I don't think that they can get much more out of it financially. But I mean, there is a question about who FIFA Pro is representing here, because I bet if you did a poll of the players of the clubs who are going to be taking part in this competition, they would all say we want to play in it for their own financial reasons, probably.
Yeah, but then in that context, we've had players. Most kind of, obviously, Rodri, the Manchester City defensive midfielder, probably the player of the year. He, you know, the guy doesn't lose a game, so he gets picked every game. And he said, I think it was around the Champions League quarterfinal with Real Madrid, that he needs a rest. He can't keep playing at this level. Other high-level players have said this as well. So something has to give. Whether, you know, we're saying the players would really want to play in this, but they can't play in everything. They've said it themselves. So what is the plan here? And as far as the leagues are concerned, the bigger question is, why are they not involved in setting a match calendar that affects them? FIFA doing it by itself that suits itself isn't fair.
Yeah, football would be nothing without the domestic leagues, the lifeblood of the game. But when you look at this tournament, you could argue some at Real Madrid, PSG, wouldn't necessarily see this as a pinnacle. It might be a bit of an inconvenience at the end of the season. But if you're a player at Red Bull Salzburg, unimaginably in this Club World Cup, look at some of the other teams, Auckland City, a FIFA Pro talking on behalf of Auckland City, or Seattle Sounders, or Esperance de Tunis. I mean, they're going to gain quite a global platform, potentially, because we don't know how much interest there really will be in this competition, given the fact there's no obvious rush of TV rights deals being announced by FIFA.
Yeah, sure. And that's the tension, isn't it, between helping a growing football across the board, building these clubs up, and the traditional heavyweight leagues and clubs. And that's always going to be there, though, isn't it?
And there's also an issue over prize money. FIFA wants to obviously suggest this is very lucrative, so it's appealing to the teams at the top of the game. But it will pose some issues if you're handing a huge windfall to, I don't know, again, Auckland City potentially. It's going to create competitive balance issues back in their own domestic leagues. I suppose unless they do things like the Premier League have, which is anchoring how much the top team can spend linked to the lowest earning side.
So we're causing problems. With more problems in terms of, and again, all of this needs to be thought out. And you mentioned this issue of the cash being distribution. How could we be so close to an event and a lot of these kind of basic structural plans for what this tournament is haven't been outlined at all. We don't know where it's going to be played, for example. We know it's in America. We don't know exactly where. No stadiums have been announced. It's said the rights aren't announced. Distribution not announced. Why is everything so kind of last minute here?
Yeah, good question. I think the competitive balancing is an important consideration, actually, because, I mean, there have been some talks of crazy amounts of money for, you know, the top clubs could get tens of millions of pounds and dollars, tens and tens of millions of pounds and dollars. So whatever league you're in, that could have a significant effect.
Yeah, the other issue is, you know, this expansion from the players' point of view and the calendar, there's only two organisations that have been expanding football, more and more and more games. It isn't any league hasn't got more teams in it in the last 20 years. None of the major leagues have got significantly bigger. Cup competitions, domestic ones, haven't expanded from what I can see. They've contracted, as of some leagues. Where we've seen expansion has come from FIFA and UEFA. So 48-team World Cups, 32-team European Championships, or is it 24-team European Championships from 16? Bigger Champions Leagues, more competitions. That's at UEFA and FIFA level.
So Nations League.
Nations League.
So introduced by Gianni Infantino at UEFA.
Yeah, so the footprint is being expanded by the people, effectively, who get to decide on the calendar. And if that isn't kind of abusive in some way or monopolistic in some way to suit the regulator, I don't know what is.
And if anything, some of the domestic competitions have got smaller. The Premier League reduced in size after starting in 1992. Things like the FA Cup gradually losing replay, soon to lose them altogether. So take a country like England. It's not adding matches domestically. It's actually reducing them.
Right. Yeah. And that's I think that's the point that these people are making. And essentially, just to sort of close off on this, is that at least let them have a formal role round the table when it affects them. And so far, we haven't seen that.
Well, while we're in North America, quite an interesting story from the Philadelphia Inquirer, from Jonathan Tannerwald, reporting on Manchester City getting a pre-agreement in place with a 14-year-old. Talk about Gianni Infantino trying to get the best players into Major League Soccer. This is a player who could be about to make his debut in MLS as the youngest ever player, but already preparing for his way into the Premier League big time.
Yeah, Kevan Sullivan, who has just signed a professional contract, age 14, with the Philadelphia Union MLS club. But yeah, Jonathan's interviewed him and his family, and it turns out this sort of quite unusual deal, or perhaps not so unusual, where Manchester City have an agreement in place with the Union to buy him, I think quite a sort of low fee, around $5 million, when he turns 18, because FIFA transfer rules ban the international transfers of under 18-year-olds unless you're in the EU. But this way, he's talking about, you know, what a dream it come true is that he'll be playing for Manchester City, or, you know, going there. Terry, these sorts of deals, have you heard other similar ones?
I have, and it's kind of, but you said small. It's quite a large number for a 14-year-old boy. $5 million. It's enormous in the scope of teenagers that young who've not played professional football. It is a big number. But yeah, so Vinicius Junior famously signed for them before he made his debut for Flamengo's first team. That was a $40 million. A Euro transfer. The same summer, they signed Rodrigo as well, who was very young, but I think he'd already made his debut. And then they both moved to Real after they'd turned 18. But I've also heard of Premier League clubs signing teenagers to pro contracts at a very young age. So you'd get somebody into your academy, and then say your scholarship contract will be converted into a 1-3 year professional at the time you turn, you know, 16, 17, 18. So that's slightly different. But the rules are always going to be skirted. Martin, you've been around for years. You've written stories about schoolboys and being clubs sort of signing them up kind of around the rules, haven't you, over the years?
It's a bit rude, isn't it, Tony? Been around for years.
But true.
Not true. Yeah, no, there are loads of these sort of similar cases. And just to say, Manchester City and the union have both declined to comment on any agreement. So I'm sure things will develop over the next 4 years.
One I forgot, it's actually a good one as an example, might be Kendry Pies, this Ecuadorian kid from who's signed for Chelsea, striker. And they announced him last summer. And he, again, is someone who's going to move to Chelsea perhaps this summer or next summer. I'm not sure. But they did sign him for several million dollars before he is eligible to move to Chelsea.
The question is if football is absolutely fine with this or it means that something needs to change. Does it benefit these youngsters in different parts of the world? The fact that they potentially can get a slice of some of the wealth from a club in the Premier League, or it's just too young for them to be traded and becoming football commodities at 14.
Yeah, I think that's a question that the game has to ask itself. I'm not sure personally what I think.
I did wonder why they didn't try to do a deal with New York City FC. Would it have been any easier, another part of the City Football Group, and then moving him to the parent club?
I'm sure it would have been easier.
But... a particular affinity with the Philadelphia team.
Yeah, so his brother plays the Philadelphia team. His father is a teacher at a school which has a sort of links to the union. So I think, and I think they've got even further back, they've got historic links with that club. So I think it's a sort of a combination of sort of, you know, family loyalty. And it can work as well with the union.
I think a lot of it is credit to the people who are running the club. They haven't spent vast amounts of money, but obviously they benefit from that relationship through the getting some players in the network, supplying players on loan as well. But this feels like it's been it's a surprise. It's a shock. If you said at the start of the season with that squad, this is a team that was going to make the Champions League, that didn't seem that possible. So that's it's an interesting story. But there are obviously issues and concerns. There's a story around the Ukrainian striker who they signed there, and some issues around that. But the bigger question, I think, right now, is this issue of having dual ownership, Manchester City Football Group or MCFC Group or whatever it's called, City Football Group, and having two teams in the Champions League. Martin, you've been looking at this stuff for a while. Now, if Manchester City finish champions of the Premier League and Girona come second, is there a risk that Girona cannot play in the Champions League because they have the same investors?
There's a risk, yeah. And I think it'll be the UEFA's, is it the Club Financial Control Body? Do they are the ones who decide? Yeah. So they'll have to look at this and they will make a decision. I mean, they allowed Red Bull, Leipzig and Salzburg to both play in the same competition by memory. If my memory is correct. So it'll be interesting to see how they make the argument. I mean, UEFA have said they're going to look at the whole multi-club ownership issue and to try and, you know, see if there's anything can be done. But I don't think that's going to be coming to force for next season, certainly. So it's going to be a very interesting decision for the UEFA body.
Well, can I speculate based on precedent? Toulouse and AC Milan last year, owned by Red Bird, that went through. Look, UEFA don't stop anyone getting into their competitions, really. And I can't imagine them standing in. They will find a way, because historically they've always found a way to allow this type of thing to happen. And I guess if you're a Girona fan, if you're a kind of football romantic in a way as well, if you forget the massive City Football Group elephant in the room around it, it'd be quite interesting to have a team like Girona in a competition like the Champions League, a new entrant, a new face for fans.
Yeah, they'll find a way of saying there's different people actually running things day to day, so there isn't sort of the same people running both teams. Approaching a year since that announcement from PIF and the PGA, still no resolution to it.
No, that's still going on. But in between times, they've struck a deal with an American group of investors that includes John Henry, the majority biggest investor in Fenway Sports Group that owns Liverpool and the Boston Red Sox. But there was news this week. Rory McIlroy, who has the golfer, 35-year-old golfer, number two in the world, for those who don't follow golf, he was opposed to the LIV deal back at the start. But now he's a big proponent of it, said to be quite close now with Yasser Al-Rumayyan, the governor of PIF and the chairman of LIV Golf. And he quit the PGA board. He was trying to get back onto the players board there. And it was interesting. He got rejected as this situation kind of rumbles on. And what people have pointed out is Tiger Woods, his business partner, in another venture, this kind of indoor golf league that they're trying to get off the ground, was one of the people that decided it's not the right time for him to come back. So again, this thing rumbles on, and good stories there for golf writers.
And also perhaps NFL franchises might be sort of gaining some. Would they get state investment? Because they are looking at selling, 30% maximum to private equity firms.
Yeah, so Bloomberg had a story in the past week. This, again, is an issue that has been going on for about 6 months to a year, that the NFL famously has a very, very, very strict rule on who can own the clubs. The other owners vet anyone who can buy into an NFL franchise or own one, more control than any other major league I can think of. What they're doing, or what they're thinking about doing, is loosening the rules to allow private equity investors. Football fans will be familiar with all of that stuff, given the amount of private equity in football clubs now. Silver Lake at Manchester City, for example, some of the Chelsea investors, Clear Lake at Chelsea Football Club as well. The NFL had said no to that, but now it's saying, looking like, at least, there's going to be an opening for that type of investor to own 30% of NFL clubs. One of the reasons why might be the fact that the valuations of these clubs are in the middle single-digit billions and going up. There aren't that many more billionaires that can own these teams. So in order for these valuations to go up, maybe you need to increase the pool of investors.
My recommendation to the NFL is don't do it.
Some free advice there, and maybe cautionary note too, given the strife that Everton have been going through. It was last September that they struck a deal to sell the majority of the club to 777 Partners. It's still not been approved by the Premier League. The question is now, will it ever be approved? Because every week we gain new information about the turmoil within 777. I mean, you know, last week it was their airline collapsing in Australia.
Surely this is the end of the road here. This was a deal that Everton had announced in September 2023, coming to the last week, 2 weeks of the Premier League season. And between then and now, the amount of negative headlines, the crazy stories about this company and its relationship with football and beyond. Now we have a London-based asset manager, Leadenhall, essentially accusing the company of fraud. They used words like Ponzi scheme in their legal complaint filed in New York. Essentially, they're saying that 777 and its founders or main partners, Josh Wander and Stephen Pascoe, had raised money from this asset manager using assets they've pledged elsewhere as collateral and even assets that don't even exist. This is quite a big deal, right?
Well, if that is proven, obviously it is a very big deal. I mean, the 777 deny it, obviously, and we should make
that. No, they haven't.
No statement.
They haven't. Well, they haven't.
Did they not give a statement to Bloomberg?
No. This is a remarkable thing here.
What has 777 said about this?
Well, I think that's also really interesting. I mean, these these allegations, and like, you're right, this is what they are at the moment, are very serious. But the filing in the court details conversations purportedly where Josh Wander, one of the founders of 7/7, agrees that these assets were wrongly assigned and kind of apologizes for those. So when we put the questions to 777, it's now been a week, there hasn't been a comment at all. And given that the allegations are so serious, you would have thought there would be, but they say they don't comment on ongoing legal issues, which might be just as well, because this is like the 16th or 17th open case this company has at the moment.
And there's issues with Standard Liège, the club there in Belgium, over, I think they're under a transfer embargo, over wages being delayed.
Yeah, this was a story written in Josimar's, the Norway-based publication. They've been kind of on top of the 7/7 story in a way almost no one else has. And what they've said here is that the former owner of Standard Liège, the former investors, are threatening to basically seize assets, seize the club because of unpaid bills. The Premier League's role here is quite interesting. So there's this owners and directors test. We don't really get that much visibility and clarity over how that kind of works. Now, with all of these headlines, what does this mean? Because the Premier League haven't said no. Do they ever say no?
Do you hope they withdraw it first and you sort of just let it drag on and on and on and hope that actually you withdraw it, you don't get them rejected? Because if you as the Premier League reject them, then that could be subject to all sorts of challenge, which wraps up the Premier League in legal issues.
Seems like that. Martin, you know the Premier League very well. Do they ever say no tacitly? They say, like, no, you're not owning it? Or how does it work?
Well, I mean, I think there's obviously straightforward things where, you know, unspent criminal convictions, they would say no. But when it's these sorts of ongoing cases around the finances, I think what they do is they lay down conditions. So, for example, the Newcastle United takeover by Saudi Arabia, they initially said that Saudi Arabia had to agree for the state of Saudi Arabia to be regarded as a director. Saudi Arabia refused. So they did refuse that takeover until they...
Did they refuse it, or did they say until you
stall it until you put changes in place, we can't approve it?
Yeah, exactly. They won't sign this off until... You know, this happens.
Because it's clear PIF didn't fail the owners and directors. They own Newcastle,
eventually did this, you know, they... Well, actually, no, I think the Premier League actually backed down on that, and they agreed that the state of Saudi Arabia wouldn't be viewed as an effective owner, but due to the sort of the legal, binding legal assurances was the phrase, wasn't it?
Who knows, maybe, you know, like a kid, you can't have the cake and ice cream until you've had your vegetables, but you just sit there with your main course plate for many, many months.
that food's getting a bit mouldy there. I mean, nine months now. The thing with the Premier League and 777 is this issue over a loan of about £160 million, is it, to a company called MSP. If they pay that off, this is what the people seem to be suggesting. If 777 find, who've loaned Everton 200 million, by the way, already, pay this loan off, people are suggesting that the Premier League's owners and directors test issue will be satisfied. That would be remarkable, wouldn't it? If they find a way to pay this money off, is that a green light then, given all of this happens? Could that happen, Martin?
I don't know. I mean, so I think there are sort of, you know, there are sort of fairly sort of restrictive conditions that I don't think the Premier League can say, look, just because somebody's got, you know, a company's got five legal claims against them, that necessarily rules them out, even though the sort of man in the street would think it should. I think sort of legally, or certainly by their rule book, I don't think it's as easy as that. But perhaps it should.
Yeah, I mean, the only certainty for Everton is they do have their Premier League status confirmed, which, of course, at some point was in doubt over the points deductions in place for the past breaches of the profit and sustainability rules. But certainly see where the 777 takeover goes, or if they are left having to negotiate, as is reported, with new takeover options from the United States.
Yeah, you get a sense this is so fast moving. You know, even by the time this recording is out, this story might have changed, and that deal might have even collapsed. So if you're listening and you've seen that news, this was recorded before that.
Yeah. Well, moving away from that into the Olympic world, and in the past, this name, this topic might have been right at the top of the pod. It shows how he's faded from the limelight. But at one time, Sheikh Ahmed of Kuwait had huge status and was a key power broker in the world of football and part of the rise of Thomas Bach to the IOC presidency just over a decade ago. But now he's been hit with a 15-year ban by the IOC.
Yeah, Sheikh Ahmed Al Sabah, the kingmaker, he was known as. In 2013, the IOC session in Buenos Aires, which you and I went to, Tariq, and he basically ran the show, didn't he? Got Thomas Bach elected, got Tokyo the Olympics, and got wrestling reinstated as an Olympic sport. It was a sort of trebles all round.
It was an extraordinary scene. Not only did he get all those victories, he was raised on the shoulders of members of the Japanese bid after they'd won. I remember being in that room. It was remarkable how much influence this man who probably almost any sports fan wouldn't have heard of. But just in that room, you see how power works in the sports world. This guy, as you said, got the trifecta through his lobbying efforts, whatever they look like. And then after that, a couple of years later, don't forget, he was an unnamed co-conspirator in a Department of Justice case that involved a football official from Guam accepting a $1 million bribe. This guy pleaded guilty to that. And who knows what the status of that is and whether Sheikh Ahmed Al Sabah is a frequent traveler to the United States or not. Since then, but this 15-year ban, what is it? I think it's in relation to a forgery conviction in Switzerland. Is that right?
Yeah, so it's not directly related to his Olympic work, is it? It is a ruling that came in January where his conviction for forgery was upheld, and it all relates to video footage presented in Kuwait showing a former prime minister discussing a coup. But then this going to the IOC Ethics Commission, which said that he betrayed his IOC members' oath by causing serious damage to the IOC's reputation. That's what's led to the 15-year ban previously banned by the Olympic Council of Asia from the election.
Yeah, remarkable. It's taken them this long to realise that he has affected their reputation through his actions. You know, it feels a little bit after the horse has bolted and an opportune time for this ban to come. I mean, given the laundry list that followed this guy before we mentioned the DOJ case, why now?
It's comparatively rapid work by the IOC Ethics Commission. I mean, Frankie Fredericks has been suspended for about 7 years. Nothing's happened over payments around the Rio Olympics.
Yes.
That's direct related to the Olympic movement.
Yeah, absolutely. This issue of the kind of opacity of the IOC's justice system, it's been run for many years by a lady called Pacaret Zappelli. Once it goes into that ethics commission, it kind of goes down a black hole until there is an announcement at the right time. You know, Graham Dunbar from the AP has been a friend of the pod. He's been asking and following the Sheikh Ahmed cases for many years. You know, I'd love to know how many, you know, questions or emails he sent to the press office about this case over the years and when action's going to be taken. And finally it has. But this is years long. He was kicked off the FIFA council as well, wasn't he? Back in 2016-17, he couldn't run because of these issues. So we're talking 6-7 years at least.
Yeah, Graham, and covering that at a weekend, something the IOC didn't actively push out there for public consumption.
The Pacaret, she must be the the longest serving sort of person in sport. It actually been in their sort of, I mean, in terms of international federations, I think, to be in the same position as she was. I think she started in 22 years ago as the head of the IRC's Ethics Commission. So, I mean, that's pretty good going, isn't it?
Quite a world this week. And thank you, everyone, for listening. As ever, you can get in touch on X, Facebook and Instagram, sportlockpod@gmail.com. But for now, thank you. Goodbye.